Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Let's start with something that has been known about for at least 5,000 years, has finally been visualized by science. I'm talking about fascia. Let me just say that doctors aren't taught anything about fascia. Ask an acupuncturist and they're like, oh yeah, fascia, and they'll tell you all about it. An osteopath, same thing. The difference between an MD and a DO is that osteopaths actually believe in fascia and know how to manipulate it. Chiropractors too, they're big on fascia. But what the heck is it? Well, fascia is basically a non-cellular pudding that's in the space between the things. So, for example, between your liver and your diaphragm, there's fascia. Between the muscles, the individual muscles, there's fascia. Part of what fascia does is separate this from that. And this pudding is made of sugary proteins and salts and collagen bundles. And it is a structure that we utilize in acupuncture. We twist it with our needles, and that causes the salts to bounce around and send signals down the plane. And there are fascial planes, you could go look this up, that connect the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. And just they tend to curve and twist around things. And if they get stuck together, they cause pain. Now, fascia can act as a lubricant, it can act as a glue, it can act as a solid. And you know that pink jelly when you, I don't know if you ever eat canned ham, but back in my childhood, that was the ham we could get, and it was in a can, and you opened it and then cooked it, and there was all this little pink jelly in there. And that was basically melted fascia. And that's the thing about fascia. It basically disappears in dead tissue. So we don't see it when we dissect a body, for example, in our training. And so we're kind of left with fascia is this thing that lines, that's the lining, that sorry, the surface area of the muscles, and it helps them slide around. And there's a little hand waving in medical school, and then they go on to the real stuff about the organs. So finally, we have invented a technology that allows, I'm going to read you the article here. The title is lovely. Structure and distribution of an unrecognized interstitium in human tissues. Interstitium, of course, means the thing between the thing, fascia, right? There is a new tool, confocal laser endomicroscopy, that provides real-time imaging of human tissues at a depth of 60 to 70 microns during endoscopy. So they were looking around with their PCLE device, and they were in the hepatic bile duct after they had injected fluorescein, and they saw fascia, a reticular pattern within fluorescein-filled sinuses that had no known anatomic correlate. Freezing biopsy tissue before fixation preserved the anatomy of the structure. Obviously, fixation means things like formaldehyde and harsh chemicals, which keep the thing from rotting, but they also destroy the fascia, so you never saw it before. Demonstrating that it is part of the submucosa and a previously unappreciated fluid-filled interstitial space, draining to lymph nodes and supported by a complex network of thick collagen bundles. The bundles are lined on one side by fibroblast-like cells that stain, and it goes on and goes on. We observed similar structures in numerous tissues that are subject to intermittent or rhythmic compression, including the submucosa of the entire GI tract and urinary bladder, the dermis, peribronchial and periarterial soft tissues, and fascia. These anatomical structures may be important in cancer metastasis, edema, fibrosis, and mechanical functioning of many or all tissues and organs. So, there's a new structure in town, folks. And it's been there all along, and it's been, the body's been exploiting it and using it, and some forms of medicine or medical care have been exploiting it all along. But now we have proof it exists, I look forward to further research on this mysterious, hitherto unobserved interstitium. I think we'll flip to an email now. As I said, we have a lot of emails to cover tonight. So our first email comes from Anonymous in Menlo Park. I'd like your advice on two questions. Are elevated levels of organic arsenic a health risk? A family member recently found to have elevated levels of organic, labeled by the lab non-toxic, arsenic, I will finish that for them, but non-elevated levels of methylated and inorganic arsenic, labeled toxic, in their urine. They were advised the organic arsenic is readily processed and not of concern. Their best guess is the exposure might have come from canned sardines. This type of arsenic is sometimes called fish arsenic because it is very high in fish, and it is arsenic that has been bonded with proteins. It's called arsenobetaine, betaine being one of the amino acids that is very common throughout the human body, very high in collagen, among other things. But anyway, the dangerous types of arsenic are those that are inorganic, and these are toxic, and typically it's oxygen or chloride or sulfur with the arsenic, which is an element, and so it complexes with other elements to form a salt, and those salts are very, very toxic and accumulate in the body, primarily in bone and other collagen-rich tissues, arsenic having a affinity for protein. Of course, if it's already bonded to the protein, fully bonded, it's harmless. It just bounces off the body and goes into the urine. Methylated arsenic is a different animal. It is also toxic. It's hooked up to a methyl group, which is a CH4 group. Of course, in getting hooked up, it loses one of those H's. But methylated arsenic has some interesting properties in that it is still lipid soluble. So it can, it is also made in algae. Algae, any will get the arsenic and that's inorganic or metallic and turn it into methylated. Does the same thing with mercury as well, which is how we get mercury in our food chain. In the case of arsenic, not so much is getting in to our food chain, and what does get in is harmless because of the arsenobetaine combination. But we can also make it in our gut, and so arsenic is something because the bacteria in our gut are very closely related to algae. So yes, this is correct. It is not the arsenobetaine is not dangerous. I'm interested in why they were tested, if that was a consumer test that they chose to get. I'm also interested in whether the arsenic was provoked, because, like you said, canned sardines, sure, you'll show up as positive. But there, but when we provoke a thing, as I said, it goes into bone, it doesn't, if you're getting a blood test or a urine test, you're not going to necessarily get high levels of this. If you give a chelator and then check the urine, you may see extremely high levels of stored arsenic that's been squirreled away in the most harmless place the body could find, but yeah, not entirely harmless. Now, the next question, are there any health concerns with consuming ultra-filtered milk and dairy products? Well, obviously, ultra-filtered is an ultra-processed food, and when you think about milk, all right, milk goes through a lot of tubing between it to get to you. First, it goes into a homogenation vat. There's, you know, it gets transported from the dairy. It gets processed, homogenized, pasteurized, and then it runs through large tubes in the factory, and those tubes are plastic, and you pick up some microplastics on the way. And milk actually does have even quote-unquote good milk, organic milk, still has a fair amount of microplastics in it. And we did a story a few months ago about how our estimation of microplastics needs to be redone using clean room gloves. So some of the current data may be incorrect, depending upon the technique of the assay and whether the sample was touched by gloves. And a lot of the tissue samples that are done to say, oh, look, this much microplastic in the brain or this much in the liver, those may have been contaminated during the preparation of the slides. So we're going to have to redo a lot of basic science there to figure out what's actually going on. But I would say that the risk-benefit ratio on milk and dairy products favors go ahead and have the milk, but maybe not necessarily ultra-filtered. You'd probably cut back a little bit on the microplastics. And obviously, because all the water is taken out of cheese, especially aged cheese, that's where you're going to find the most microplastics, which makes me very sad because I love cheese. All right, and coming up, another email, this from Kim in Santa Cruz. And Kim writes, "Hi, Dr. Dawn. I've been referred for a breast MRI. I recall you saying that the contrast gadolinium is an issue for some patients. For contrast breast MRI, what do you recommend? Do you have a preference for the type of gadolinium, macrocyclic or linear? Also, is it possible to do a breast MRI without contrast agents?" And then secondary question, "Are there any supplements, foods, or protocols you recommend to help the body clear or detox from gadolinium after a contrast MRI? I appreciate your perspective. Thanks for all you do for patient education." All right, so I'm going to start with answering question number two, which is it possible to do a breast MRI without contrast agents? And the answer is no. Unfortunately, if you try to do a gadolinium-free MRI, you're not going to see the difference between the tumor and the breast. And the whole reason to do this is if the breast is dense, and so we're not sure the X-rays are penetrating fully in a mammogram, so we want more contrast. The tumors leak. They have these thrown-together blood vessels that haven't formed properly, and so they leak the gadolinium, and the surrounding breast tissue doesn't, so they create that contrast. The question about which type, I actually, thank you, you made me learn something. I had to look up the two types of gadolinium, macrocyclic and linear, and they have interesting different structures. So the macrocyclic is more like a crystal. It's kind of like a birdcage structure. And the linear is more slidey and slippery, you know, linear. So it tends to slip into other tissues. So a lot of it stays in your bones, a moderate amount in your skin. Some of it even gets into the deep structures of the brain, like the caudate nucleus, which is creepy. It also gets into the liver and spleen. And it lives there for at least 8 years. That's what the science says. Since I do provoked heavy metal testing on a lot of patients where I give them a chelating agent, then these chelating agents, Susomer is the one that was used in Flint, Michigan for all the kids with lead poisoning. And you take this thing, it goes into your empty stomach, it goes out into your body tissues, it goes everywhere and it grabs metal. It'll grab copper, it'll grab zinc, it'll grab gadolinium, and then it comes out in your urine after 4 or 5 hours, it's all gone, and you get a sort of core sample that you can analyze. And I started doing this a decade ago using chelating agents, and I could tell who had had an MRI ever in their life. And some of the patients, I was like, gadolinium, huh? Well, that's used in MRI. Have you ever had an MRI? Yeah, 15 years ago, doc, I had an MRI. And I'm like, okay, well, you've still got some of that stuff in there. The linear is actually a little bit scary because it hangs in there and it causes a syndrome called nephrogenic systemic fibrosis, which is a scarring in the kidneys. And the linear is also, when it gets into the brain, it's dicey because it's tied to neuroinflammatory pathways. And we know that aging in the brain and dementia are a neuroinflammatory phenomenon. There are others that are neuroinflammatory, like the childhood pandas syndrome. So I'm going with stay away from the linear. Put it on your list of drug of sensitivities. Tell people you are sensitive to linear gadolinium and have that on your problem list. That there's room in the space. You can have as many drug sensitivities as you want. And I intend to declare one on my own chart as soon as I have the opportunity to speak with my primary care doctor, because I want that to be on my list of things I don't want to be given when I'm unconscious. So let's go to our next story. We're on weird and wonderful science. So let's move to harnessing semen-derived exosomes. Okay, so let's go back first. Pharmacy, all right? There used to be these things called apothecaries, and they would buy, you know, metals and glycerin and various other chemical compounds, and they would have their own little chemistry lab, and they would put together drugs. And there were recipes, of course, and so you have this pharmacopoeia and these recipes, and they would put together things, and they would either put them in a liquid or put them in pills. And the pills were essentially powders that were moistened and then pressed together, sometimes with a binder. A lot of times the pills crumbled when you put them in your mouth. They were bitter. Most medicines are bitter. And so people were always trying different things in to make the drugs more palatable and to make them last longer. And then commercially available gelatin capsules came along, and the angels sang, because now you could take this nice, smooth, easy-to-swallow thing that wasn't going to crumble, it melted in your gut, and you could deliver these drugs that were hard to deliver otherwise. And we all lived happily after for a while, but new drugs come out, and the trouble is you can't get them from point A to point B through the mouth or through the veins. So our first story is about sperm. Well, not quite sperm, semen-derived exosomes. So exosomes are essentially a bubble with something inside it, and their secret power is that they can fuse to the cell membrane, so they can get across tissue and get to the other side. And in this case, they used semen-derived exosomes to penetrate ocular barriers owing to their epidermal growth factor expression, which mediates reversible tight junction disruption. Let me translate that for you, because it's fun. When a sperm meets an egg, there is a barrier around the egg, and the sperm has to melt through the barrier, hence the tight junction disruption. It gets the first sperm that gets in actually triggers an electrical burst that makes the egg impermeable to any additional sperm, because that's always a bad idea genetically. So by using these semen-derived exosomes, they're able to get through the front of the eye and get all the way back behind the cornea and get to the retina. So they took these little bubbles and they filled them with something called CMG, which is a nanozyme system. Zyme means a molecular scissors. And this molecular scissors jumps to the back of the eyeball to treat retinoblastoma cells, which are a type of cancer of the eyeball. And because it contains this CMG compound, manganese dioxide, glucose oxidase, it basically triggers cell destruction. So it kills the cancer cells and goes, you know, right to work without you having to stick a needle in the eye or put caustic stuff into the bloodstream in the hope that you'll get a high enough level. And retinoblastoma is actually a childhood ocular malignancy. It's more commonly seen in children. And most of our chemotherapy, putting injections in the eyes, freezing the eyeball, radiation to the eyeball, they all really damage the eyeball. And they cause systemic toxicity. And most of the time, the way you treat these cancers is by removing the eyeball, which is, of course, a rather radical solution to a problem. So these exosomes are naturally secreted by cells. They come off of the sperm, and you can harvest them in the semen and load them with the drugs. And these evolved to facilitate sperm penetration, to get, you know, where they need to get to successfully fertilize the egg. And there are a number of proteins that are part of this system that are very special and unique to sperm. This is a first study looking at this as a delivery vehicle for a chemotherapeutic agent that is too toxic to give by any other method. But obviously, as they said in one of my a book with which I have a long history, and if you are a doctor or a nurse, I recommend it. If you are a patient, I recommend against it. It's called The House of God. And there are a number of adages in the House of God, and one of them is there is no place in the human body that cannot be reached by a 12-gauge needle and a strong arm. And that is probably true. The trick is what you hit on your way in, but seriously, these exosomes are going to take us somewhere, and it's not just exosomes. It's also extracellular vesicles. This next article came from the Journal of Extracellular Vesicles. These are tiny structures that naturally transport genetic material between cells. They are actually, this is actually going on in your body right now. Some of your cells are excreting messenger RNA and sending it to other cells to be. It is very important for regulating a lot of biological processes in the brain. They modulate and regulate gene and cellular pathways. Messenger RNA, of course, can be a negative one. If you sense that the cell next to you is making too much of something, you could send over some counter reverse RNA that would, the messenger RNA would block the RNA that's being transcribed in the cell that's kind of overdoing things. You could shut it down or at least slow it down. And it turns out this sort of communication and complex regulation is a natural part of the stuff going on in the brain. These cells are being used as these extracellular vesicles here are being used to try and reverse brain aging. And how do you get them in? Well, this is again back to why we love these little bubbles. These vesicles can penetrate, they can get into the brain through the nose. So if you squirt it into the nose, and I have to digress and just say the idea that you have a nasal spray for that you're using in mice is kind of amazing, just in terms of the practical aspects of getting something small enough to go into a mouse nose. But apparently, you know, research marches on. And they have established that it shuts down inflammation in the brain. These are MRIs that are against the NLRP2 inflammasome, which is like the root of all prostaglandin evil, and it's like the gene set for inflammation. Very useful when you're trying to kill a bug that's invaded your body, but also linked to aging-related brain inflammation. So having done this in mice, of course, they killed the mice and took a close look at what happened in the cells. And what they found was that it restored activity in the mitochondria. And the nerve cells in the brain have a ton of mitochondria, and aging and the inflammation, the inflammaging that comes with it, can damage mitochondria. And they found that the mice seem to recover their ability to process and store information. Behavioral testing as well as biological measurements showed that treated models performed significantly better on memory and recognition, and untreated controls did not improve. So this is very, very promising. It's very early. As I say, it's a mouse study. But the idea that there's maybe someday going to be a nasal spray that you give to people when they start to develop signs of cognitive deterioration, and you are able to halt or even reverse the process, at least there's a way in that doesn't involve injections. And that in and of itself is huge, because how do you get stuff across that old devil blood-brain barrier? Well, the answer is through the nose. Yep, that should have been obvious. All right, so let's go to our next email. This email came, let's see, I don't think it's signed because it got forwarded from, so I'll just use anonymous. And here we go. My wife went to Kaiser here in Washington State after moving from Kaiser in Scotts Valley and found she is 2 inches shorter than before. She is physically active, has a healthy diet, and shows no sign of bone distress. What do you recommend for her situation? Below is a partial GPT transaction. Thank you for insight you might provide on medical tests that should be ordered. So, and I guess this is coming from Nick. So thank you, Nick. What would he also asked, what would be your recommendations from a functional medicine standpoint? And so let's first of all talk about measurement error and the fact that sometimes people have different techniques for doing measurements. And the first question I would have would be shoes. Does she remember the doctors always having her take off, or rather the medical assistants, having her always take off her shoes for her last measurement? I was a Kaiser patient for a while, and I noticed that they were pretty inconsistent about the shoes. They did measure my height each time, but sometimes I was wearing 2-inch heels. So I don't know what anybody made of that. I suspect that they don't change the number, and they just measure it, and it goes into the chart. It goes somewhere into the chart. The wife does weigh 100, and this is the chatbot talking. And this is if a person's postmenopausal, and it's important to consider the possibility of osteoporosis. However, some people lose up to 4 inches without having any osteoporosis, because what's happening is that their discs are deflating. So first we have measurement error, then we have if the measurement is real, what are the alternative things to think about besides a compression fracture of the spine? And the discs disease, you blow out a disc, you lose height, you blow out another disc, or your disc sort of sags on the edges and flattens out like a pancake. Those do happen. And so the first thing on a person like this is to look at a bone scan. And bone scans have gone through, let's do them every 2 years on everybody, to now it's like, well, let's do it once, you know, in their 50s, and then decide if we want to do it again. I'm of the opinion that you do want a bone scan at the time of menopause, because studies have shown us that people lose actually quite a bit of bone before their periods actually stop, because the estrogen levels are flailing around and it confuses the osteoblasts, and they slow down when the estrogen levels are low, and you end up with a dysregulated system and you leak calcium out of there. So weight-bearing exercise during perimenopause, jumping jacks, jumping rope, hiking up and down hills, these are all really important things to be doing anyway as a preventative. And some people will develop osteoporosis for different reasons. I'm not going to go into the details. The other thing I usually will get at the time of the bone scan is either a C-terminal telopeptide, that's telopeptide, or a T-terminal telopeptide. Telopeptides are part of the bone matrix that gets laid down before mineralization. I often use the description of bricks and mortar. So if you can imagine that it was possible to recycle mortar, if you break down a wall that you're going to rebuild the wall, you would save both the bricks and the mortar and you would reuse them, and that's your calcium and your matrix. But if you aren't rebuilding as fast as you're breaking down, you're going to have extra matrix lying around, and the extra matrix will be circulating in the bloodstream and eventually being eliminated by the kidneys. So you can find it in the urine and you can find it in the blood. And some doctors prefer the blood. I'm agnostic on this, blood, or it doesn't matter to me which one we have. The point is you establish a baseline and then you watch for that going up. And if it increases and there's been no bone fracture or anything that would cause bone to be broken down more rapidly around the fracture, then you know something is going on. So looking at the bone scan, looking at the C-terminal telopeptides, looking at the overall nutrition of the person, it sounds like this person has very good nutrition, and looking for a parathyroid hormone, what we call an intact PTH, in the bloodstream, because 4 inches is a lot. And if the person has a tumor in their parathyroid gland, they're so-called because they're sitting behind the thyroid or next to the thyroid, and they're teeny tiny little glands, but they regulate calcium. And if they decide that the body needs more calcium and they keep pumping out that parathyroid hormone, it'll suck calcium out of the bones. And of course, that's how you get that bone fracture, which sometimes can be painless, that could lead to a height loss. So lots of possibilities to be checked out there. And I think we've answered those questions. The brain contains roughly 86 billion neurons. That number sort of makes it sound like the scale of human cognition follows from the scale of the cell count. But the brain actually can do a lot more than the 86 billion neurons would be expected to do based on the current model for how the brain works. So we need a new model, and I'm going to tell you about this model based on research that's very intriguing. So when we think of brain cell function, we think about neurons, but there's actually three types of cells. There's the microglia. Those are fascinating, by the way. They're from a macrophage-derived line, and they specialize in the brain. And during brain development in childhood, they actually are pruning our brains. So neurons that are being stimulated by certain sounds or certain colors or certain physical activities or movement, those neurons don't touch them. But the stuff that isn't being used, that isn't being stimulated, gets trimmed away, literally eaten away by these cells who are amoebas, and their ability is to eat bacteria or brain cells. And during early childhood development, they're eating brain cells and shaping the brain. When we look at the brains of children with autism, one of the things we say is that they haven't been well pruned. They have more neurons left than they should, and that may account for the flooding and the interference with certain cognitive activities that come naturally to the rest of us that people, particularly people with severe autism, experience. Aside from the microglia and the neurons, there's a third type of cell called the astrocyte, which has been sort of, we thought we knew what it did. Okay, we thought that it created the myelin sheath because it sends out these little stems, and then the tip of the stem flattens and wraps around the neuron so that it is myelinated, which allows the neurologic signal to travel much, much faster, more than 10 times faster when you have a myelinated neuron. So the astrocytes That's what they do, but that may not be all that they do. And much of this hypothesis comes from a mathematical model. So I'm going to go back, step back a minute and talk about mathematical models. So there was this guy in the 80s named James Hopfel who tried to model how neural networks would store information. And he used that as a working model. The patterns of connection between neurons were how memory was stored. But the Hopfield hypothesis basically doesn't account for all of the memory that we have, that we demonstrably have, even using all 86 million neurons. So we're doing something else with those neurons than just plugging a plug into the wall and sending a signal on. It's deeper than that with more levels. There's a modified version called dense associative memory, but this requires couplings between more than two neurons at a time, and we don't see that. Conventional synapses connect exactly two neurons, one presynaptic and one postsynaptic. There's no biological mechanism for higher order coupling, yet we have dense associative memory. So those astrocytes, I said, that make the myelin sheet and wrap around the synapses, one single astrocyte can connect through those little linear projections that they send out hundreds or thousands of synapses. And where it wraps around a synapse, it's called a tripartite synapse. It's a three-way junction involving the presynaptic neuron, the postsynaptic, and the astrocyte. Now, astrocytes can't fire electrical action potentials, but they communicate through calcium signaling, and they release actual neurotransmitters, well, they're called gliotransmitters, into the synaptic junction. So what this model says is that the astrocyte is acting like a rheostat to control multiple synapses and turn them up and turn them down. Strengthening them, of course, would lead to a complex association between a whole group of neurons that could form the structure of the brain that allows me to pick up my flute and play a scale without thinking of it. That's, or riding a bicycle, or speech for that matter. These are all very complicated things that require a whole lot of neurons working in concert. And this may not just be a memory. This may be a lot of learning. So the idea is that the astrocyte is sensing the neural activity of the neurons that it's literally got its hands on and is feeding information back, perhaps even selectively at different locations. That's not clear, but it could be. And when you do the math on this, the authors of this paper say that each unit can store as many memory patterns as there are neurons in the network. This is an arbitrarily large number of patterns, so it could get very deep and very complex. The model has something to say about energy efficiency. The ratio of the stored information is cheaper from an energy standpoint when you connect things this way into a network rather than having it be multiple linear lines. Again, if you do the math, it makes sense from an energy standpoint. And there have been some studies, it's very early, but for a couple of years, people have been, okay, what's the astrocyte really do? Does it do more than that? And of course, the first thing we do in neuroscience when we ask the question, what does it do, is we destroy it and see what happens. And then if the animal stops moving its left leg, it's like, well, that has something to do with motor function in the left leg. And so studies disrupting astrocyte neuron connections in the hippocampus, which is where we think of the hippocampus as the giant memory switchboard, where have reported impairments in both memory storage and retrieval, and also advances in calcium imaging resolution have made it possible to observe astrocytes and neurons coordinating their activity in real time. So whether this model is exactly correct or way out in left field, the fact that astrocytes provide the seem to be communicating with neurons in ways that we have not previously seen, and that theoretically, at least, they would provide the circuitry for this complex, deep associative memory makes it seem like, it's a big question mark, but it's also very, very plausible. Now, don't fall in love with plausibility. That is one of our problems in science. But still, I think it's very important. Let's go to scientists discover a hydraulic link between the abdomen and the brain. A recent study published in Nature Neuroscience suggests the brain is more mechanically connected to the body than previously appreciated. Scientists found that abdominal muscle contractions, that is to say, sit-ups, compress blood vessels that are actually connected to the brain and the spine, pushing fluid that gently moves the brain within the skull. So literally, when you do a sit-up, your brain lifts like a boat lifts on the waves in the ocean. So this physical swishing in the skull may explain how exercise benefits brain health by essentially helping the brain clear toxins. The researchers were building on previous studies looking at sleep and neuron loss and how they could influence when cerebral fluid flushes through the brain. We know that that cerebral flushing occurs and that it's part of how the brain gets rid of the garbage. And we also know that most brain degeneration is the hallmark of it is the accumulation of garbage in the brain. So it's like a hydraulic system. The abdominal muscles contract. They push blood into the spinal cord. It applies pressure to the brain. It makes the brain bounce a little bit in the skull. That's going to drive fluid in and out of the brain, just like swishing a cup or a bottle in water rather than just letting it sit there. And it's probably helping prevent neurodegenerative disorders. I won't go into the gory details of how they did the study, but I'll just say that the researchers had a transparent window surgically placed into the mice's brains, and they put them on a treadmill and watched them run. And they watched the brain shift around, and it was roughly, basically when the mice were running, the brain would go forward and to the side, forward and to the side, as the mouse moved. And they later on went on to look at the abdominal muscles, because of course it was timed with the breathing. So they said, breathing, abdominal movement. They injected a special dye into the mice, and they showed a special network of veins called the vertebral venous plexus, which was connected to the abdominal cavity. So it's like there's a direct connection there. And so then they applied gentle and controlled pressure to the abdomens of lightly anesthetized mice. They built a custom pneumatic belt, like a miniature blood pressure cuff, and then they looked at their brains again, and it says, with no other movement than a localized mechanical pressure, the mice brains shifted. And so then they said, okay, it's abdominal contraction. And they went on doing science and basically showed that the brain, that they could demonstrate a mechanism where they could see fluid moving in and out of the brain. And I'm not quite sure. I think this was a computer simulation, just looking at all the geometry and the previous studies. And so the idea is maybe we should all be doing sit-ups every morning or maybe every night to help our brain clean itself out. We know that that happens during sleep. Maybe there will be somebody making a inflatable vest or binder that you'll wear around your abdomen that will just inflate enough to push the fluid, make your brain go up, make your brain go down while you sleep, and help you clean your brain. Kind of crazy idea. But everything is connected. And I'm going to kind of end on this note. with one more story. Everything is connected. And so when you have the toe, there are fascial planes that connect the toe literally to the opposite, to the ear on the opposite side of the body. These are mapped. There are connections between the flow of blood through the body, the pressure within the CSF. We've known this, but when they demonstrate that maybe this is a way to help us avoid dementia, it starts to get funding. And we love it, and I love to talk about these stories. So our last story of tonight is how a common asthma drug helps fight hard-to-treat cancers, including aggressive breast cancers. We're talking about triple-negative breast cancer, which is one of the most aggressive and difficult-to-treat cancers. And research found that there's a protein that's hijacked by these tumors in particular that turns the immune cells into sleeper agents. The immune cells would normally directly kill the tumor cells, but instead they rally other immune cells help create a tumor environment. The way these cells work is they release a compound that dissolves tissue. So instead of trying to fight the cancer, they actually clear the path for the cancer to make its way through the tissues. There's already a drug on the market that blocks this. It's called Montelukast, and it's historically been used to treat asthma and allergies. So this idea that you can repurpose old drugs and find strategies for letting them do something completely different from what they were built to do, this repurposing is happening more and more now as AI is looking at the shape of things and the shape of receptors and finding things that will fit like jigsaw puzzle pieces that our brains just aren't able to look at the molecular structure and sort that out. So bravo to AI. It's a bug and a feature, and this is part of the feature. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.